the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 584 for Saturday, December 19th, 2015.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's We're going to have to ask you to come in on Saturday edition of Mac Geek Gab, the show where the goal is to learn at least a few things each and every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include Harry's, where coupon Shave 5 off saves you $5. Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com with some great deals we'll tell you about. Linda at Linda.com/MGG, where you get 10 days for free. And our friends at Barebones Software at Barebones.com, makers of the finely crafted BB Edit. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, still looking for my red stapler, this is John F. Braun.
That's right. Yeah. Ace frio, John. It got cold finally for me here.
Same here. They said we may even get flurries today, so it's getting towards freezing. So yeah, party's over.
Yeah. My dad's over in Vermont, had some snow. I have this Nest thermostat here in the studio, and I got up really early this morning because we had a hockey game with my son that had like a 7:30 face off. But when the game finished, I was like, oh, I got to set the thing. And so I set the schedule for the Nest so that the heat would come on in the studio here. And when I came over, it wasn't on. I don't know, the setting must not have stuck or whatever, but it's warming up in here, but it's like 60 Fahrenheit, which is still cold, but you know,
mm-hmm.
Yep. So let's get this out of the way, John. And no, we're not going to give any spoilers, but have you seen the new Star Wars movie yet, John?
Not yet.
Okay. All right. I saw it with the family last night and I highly recommend it. Absolutely fantastic. Really, really one of the best. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, JJ.
Yeah.
He knows what he's doing.
He does. He does. I can't wait till you see it, 'cause I want to have a conversation with you about it. It's, you know, there's lots to discuss, which is good. That's what these movies are about.
The dark side is more powerful, I think.
Yeah. Well, now not only do I want the next movie, but I want this next Star Trek movie too. 'Cause why not?
Oh yeah. I saw some previews for that. That looks pretty, looks pretty good.
Yep. And I'm also really excited. We just played a song in pre-show from the band Weather Report, but I'm really excited to watch the new Jocko movie about Jocko Pistorius, which is obviously has nothing to do with sci-fi, unless you consider Jocko a Jedi of the bass guitar. And I think there's an argument that could be made there. So anyway, let's see where we're at, John. So last week we started sharing some quick tips, which is what we'll call them, because we'll do this as a little segment. We've been doing cool stuff found every show recently. It was a nice thing to do during kind of the holiday buildup because there was lots of stuff. We will now alternate quick tips with cool stuff found. And quick tips are just these things that we do every day in our computing life, but not everybody does every day. And they're the kind of things that it's so easy to even forget that we do them. And that's why we want to share, because the point is to learn new things when we get together. So I will start with one of mine, and then we've got a couple from you folks that sent them in. When you're taking a screenshot, we all know that you can do Command Shift 4, and that takes a screenshot of your entire desktop, all the screens that you have, and saves them to files, right? And that's great. And you can do Command Shift 3 takes a screenshot of everything and saves it to a file. Command Shift 4 lets you either draw, it'll give you crosshairs, and you can either draw or you can hit the space bar to alternate the crosshairs into a camera, which takes a picture of whatever window you hover the mouse over, which is cool. But if you add the control key to either of those, Command Shift 3 or Command Shift 4, it will put the screenshot on the clipboard. And that's a really handy thing, especially for you folks that are sending in screenshots to us. Nothing is handier than just doing, you know, a command shift 3 or command control shift 3 or 4, depending on whether you want to show us the whole screen or just a part of it. And then you just paste it into your email that you send to feedback@macgeekgab.com, and you're good to go. It's how it works. So that's mine to share for today. And do you have anything to add to that one, John, or is it time to move on to Larry's quick tip?
I do, and I'm looking for it. Okay, I found an article on it. There's also a way you can set the... you have to do some mysterious terminal stuff here, or you could use a couple of different utilities here. But there is a way to also set the format of the screenshot.
Cool.
What comes out here? Let's see. I think it's... Oh, okay. Well, it's pretty simple here. So... default space write space com.apple.screencapture space type space. And then I see one example here that's JPEG. I think I actually have mine set for PNG.
I believe they're PNG by default in OS X right now.
But I think you can also, I think you can set JPEG, I think GIF and TIFF
cool.
as well, depending on what you'd like. So we'll link to a quick one. Yeah, I default to PNG because I think that's the nicest format.
Cool. Yeah. All right. And then Larry writes, he says, when you update a multi-user Mac to a new OS, make sure you sign into all of the user accounts after the update completes. I updated to 10.11.2 from 10.11.1, but did not sign into my wife's account immediately on the machine. I could not complete a Time Machine backup until I had signed into her account. Seems the update does not completely finish until after all the user accounts are signed in. It took a lot of console and Google searches to solve this problem. Time Machine would just get stuck and would not complete until I had logged into all of the accounts on the machine. Very interesting, Larry. I've also found that it's handy after any kind of updates like that to make sure you launch mail, especially if you have a large mail archive, because... it's going to need, you know, a lot of times, not every time, but a lot of times it's going to need to go through and kind of clean through the mail database anyway. So yeah, great tip, man. That's what it's about. And Graham, well, Graham just, he takes the cake because Graham has, I believe, 7 tips to share. So here we go. Number one, he says these are things that he gives to his clients who are just getting started with their new Macs. So, number one is turn on the secondary click on the mouse or trackpad and then demonstrate, right? So, you know, we can control click on things. You can assign that. And it is assigned by default to Apple's devices with a, you know, on the trackpad, it's a 2-finger click and that sort of thing. So very, very handy. He says, turn on it, go into System Preferences, General, and turn on the Always Show for the scroll bars. Says everybody that I work with gets frustrated by disappearing scroll bars, and some get very confused because without a scroll bar, there's no visual cue that the window has more scrollable content. And it's true, man. That's one that I have on all my machines, and I would never think to suggest it because it's just automatic. So perfect. He says he likes to demonstrate full screen mode to people, not so that they can use it, but so that they know what it is and how to get out of it if they find themselves there. And let's see, we'll finish these up. Command tab with to use the application switcher. Again, this is a thing we all use every day. This is a great start to this segment because these are just these foundational things. Command and tab lets you switch applications. And if you hold down the shift key while you're on command and tab, or if you hit command tab and keep the command key down, you can hit tab to go from app to app. If you hold down the shift key, it goes the other direction. If you hit Q, it will quit the app over which you are hovering. So fun stuff. This is one that with great power comes great responsibility, John. He recommends showing people how to do a hard shutdown by holding the power button for 5 seconds. Sometimes it's a little more than 5, but you're right. Yeah, you hold down the power button until it turns off. This is not something you want to do unless it is the only thing you have left. But if it is the only thing you have left, very handy to know that you can do it so that you don't have to call someone for help if your computer's truly locked up. Print to PDF from any print dialog. That's a handy thing. He says Windows user converts can't believe how simple it is. And lastly, using image capture to scan from your scanner rather than the crappy bloatware provided by printer manufacturers. And he's right. Image capture works with most scanners, not all of them, but most. So thank you, Graham. Thank you, Larry. And please do send those in to us, because we'll include these every couple of weeks to kick things off with the show. Right? Good stuff.
Fantastic.
Lantastic is what I like to say, John. But that sends us back days and days and days. All right. And many days, years, Lantastic. I don't even, are they still in business? I don't know. It was a good name. That's about it. Douglas writes, in episode 581, you talked a little bit about using Facebook or Twitter credentials to log into another site. I'm a little unclear on one thing. When I agree to log into another site using my Facebook account info, is the site I'm logging in able to see my actual username and password, or does it go through the Facebook site for verification only with the new site having access to this information, or without the new site having access to this information? Yeah, it's the latter, Douglas. And there's a protocol called OAuth, or Open Authentication, where what happens is you get a token back from the authentication provider, in this case Facebook, that says, yeah, this person's authorized, but it's not your password. It's a unique token for just that particular authorization for you into that app that time. And that's how this is done, and it keeps your Facebook data safe. Now, when you do that authentication the first time, sometimes Facebook will come up and Google does this too, right? Because Google offers an OAuth thing, and lots of people do, as we said, Twitter does as well. It will come up and tell you, hey, look, whoever you're logging in to is asking not only to have us be your login credentials, but they're also asking to see your email address or post to your wall, right? I mean, you know, with Facebook, you can ask for all of these things, but you as the user have the opportunity to accept or decline these additional features, if you will, that whatever service you're using is asking for. But that'll be presented clearly on the screen. Just make sure you read the screen and you don't just, you know, treat it like an end user license agreement and click through. But you'll be in good shape. All good. Thoughts, my friend?
And I've seen there's a comment or a discussion service, Discus.
Discuss.
Discus.
Yeah.
Discuss. Oh, that's how you say it.
I would assume that's how you say it. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that too. So it's a discussion system that revolves around using, from what I can see, either a Facebook or a Twitter login. So.
Yeah, so. Right. It'll log in. You can log in to discuss whatever it is with Facebook or with their own credentials, just like we have at TMO. You can log into TMO with our credentials or your TMO credentials or Facebook or Twitter. You want to take us on to Mark, John?
Yeah, here's a mysterious one.
I was going to bring this up last week and forgot. So I'm glad that you saw this question from Mark. So yeah, go ahead.
Well, I want to solve it. So, So Mark says, simple question. What happened to keychain access first aid?
It's keychain gone.
First aid.
Yeah. Well, but it was in keychain access. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's weird. I got to figure if there's a secret way to reactivate it or run it. And I tried a few different things.
So let me explain here. As of 10.11.2, and this did not happen prior, the keychain access app that is in 10.11.2 no longer has the option to run keychain first aid in either the keychain access menu or the window menu. It has been in both places over the years. Apple's knowledge base article, which when I checked the other day, I didn't check today, was last updated in February, and it said to find it in the window menu. I don't even think that was correct in February. I think it has been in the keychain access menu, but regardless, it is not there now. And no, we tried this because Brian Chaffin here at TMO was having trouble with his keychain, and he needed to repair it. And there, you know, we tried option key and launch with this and, you know, hold your mouth just right and, you know, sacrifice to the sun gods or whatever it was. Nothing worked. We did not try using the force on it, John, but otherwise we tried everything.
And I was hoping there was a way to run it. Maybe if you try to run the app from the command line and then provide an argument. But I wasn't able to. A lot of things. If you try to run them from the command line and you just enter them, they sometimes will give you a list of options, or you may have to ask for them.
Yeah.
So you know, if you run a program space, and a lot of times it's, you know, dash H for help or something similar, it'll list, you know, oh well, you know, if you enter this when you run me, then I'll do these extra nice things for you. But a keychain access doesn't do that. Now, what's funny, Dave, is that if you go to the help in keychain access, which, you know, you go to keychain access help, and then there's a troubleshooting category, and it says if you have a problem with keychains, and you know what it tells you to do? It tells you to run keychain first aid.
Absolutely. And the knowledge base article, which I'll put in the show notes, still says do this. It was last updated February 13th of this year. So, yeah.
And the other thing that I noticed is that if you open up the package, there's still something in there, Dave, called keychainfirstaid.strings, which is a resource that allegedly contains the strings that are used by the keychain first aid function. And that's still in there. So I don't know if somebody just blew it and made a mistake.
People were reporting
all indications are that it should still be there.
If you look in the developer forums, people were reporting it in the betas of 10.11.2 as well. So this, I mean, which is not surprising, but the fact that it was reported there, I would have to assume Apple pays some attention to the developer forums, but it was missing there and no word, you know, no word came back that I know of. It's weird though, because I get that Apple, you know, I mean, it's one thing to take away repair permissions because, and there's some reasoning behind that, which we've discussed, but keychain first aid, it's like, well, this stuff, I mean, we're users, we're still touching our keychains constantly as our sync services. It's like, I think we still kind of want this. I think it's a mistake.
I hope. Well, I'm convinced there's a way to activate it. We just have to figure it out. So,
yeah, well, I haven't found one, and I haven't found anyone that has, but if anybody out there knows, man, this is, you know, the ultimate geek challenge. So, and if you're one of the listeners who works at Apple and you can flip the switch to turn it back on, well then, you know, you win the geek challenge. So there's that, and you can take great satisfaction in that and knowing that you helped us, that warm, fuzzy feeling that sits right where it needs to. I don't know where that is, but anyway. Yeah. All right. Well, we shall see. Hey, I want to take a minute, John, and talk about our first two sponsors here, if that's okay with you.
Very good.
All right. Our first sponsor today is Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com. They're one of my favorite companies in our industry because they know what they're doing and they care about getting you the right stuff. They even have their own lab there where they test stuff both before they send it out and if there happens to be a problem, where they test it when it comes back. They understand what they're doing and they're obsessive about it. They also understand that they need to sell you stuff at a good price. I went through and I found a couple of things. Their newer tech, Power to You, starts at $19, right? This is a replacement for your electrical outlet. And it gives you two electrical outlets, as you would expect, plus two USB ports. Starts at $19. This thing's great. You can charge an iPad with it at full speed, or you can split the power between the two ports and charge two iPhones simultaneously. Works really well. Fully UL listed. It's safe. $19 is where it starts. They also sell used computers there. You want a MacBook Pro? At the moment, while I'm looking, this changes all the time because it's used stuff, so they don't have unlimited inventory. Less than $350 for a mid-2010 at MacBook Pro. That's pretty good. You want a MacBook? Less than $200 for those. You got to check this out. iMacs starting at $149 as I'm looking at this. Got to go to the website, macsales.com, check it out. But man, if you can get an iMac for the kitchen, that's an awesome price. They also have a cool thing. I've talked a lot about their drive adapters, their newer tech universal drive adapter and their Voyager that lets you put bare hard drives connected right to your computer. They've got their new OWC drive dock. It's a dual bay solution. It's got two bays. It's Thunderbolt 2. It's USB 3. Each bay can hold 2.5 or 3.5 inch disks, and each bay has a separate power supply. So if you want to unmount one drive and spin it down while you put a new drive in, the other one doesn't have to come offline to do it. You got to check all this out. MacSales.com. That's Otherworld Computing. Thanks so much to Otherworld Computing for sponsoring this episode. Harry's.com has actually made me enjoy shaving. I enjoy the process of it, and I enjoy the results. They sell fantastic quality razors at a really affordable price, probably half of what I would expect to spend if I was going to the pharmacy, or heaven forbid I go to some specialty shop, then it's probably, you know, a quarter of what I'd spend there. This stuff is fantastic. Really, really smooth, easy shave. Beautiful handles for their razors, no matter which one you get. And you can start at $15, and that's retail. You're a Mac Geek Gab listener. You don't pay retail. Use the coupon code SHAVE5OFF to save $5. So you can actually start with a handle, either shaving cream or shaving gel, and three blades for $10. I was going to say 15, but you know, SHAVE5OFF, $10, shipped to you for free. That's the Truman set. If you want something that's a little nicer, they actually have the Winter Winston set, which comes with a copper handle and all the rest of the stuff. It's gorgeous. You got to check it out, and it's limited edition. That's $30 retail. You don't pay retail, so it's $25 for you. New blades, all of that stuff. You can order it right there online. They make it super, super easy. One thing I'm really happy about is Harry's now has a travel kit. I got to be honest, as much as I love shaving with Harry's, it was too easy for me to just take my old electric razor on trips with me. Well, now with Harry's travel kit, I don't have to do that anymore. It makes it really easy to tighten all the stuff together, pack it in my suitcase. I can bring it with me, and I can enjoy having a nice shave even when I'm not in my own house. Hotel room, that kind of thing, works great. You got to check this all out. Go to harrys.com and then make sure you use coupon code SHAVE, the number 5, OFF. That's SHAVE 5, OFF. That saves $5 off your first order. Our thanks to Harry's for sponsoring this episode. And with that, John, I want to go to Ken, because this is sort of the opposite of what we were talking about last week. Ken updated to El Capitan, and he says it went just fine with one serious exception. Mail.app started using immense quantities of RAM and would eventually crash. He says, with testing, the problem was identified as my office's Exchange account. Mail would work fine for my Gmail account and fine for my iCloud account. But if the Exchange account hosted by Microsoft in the cloud at office365.com was active, while it might bring in new mail on open, it would typically crash within the first minute or so. And while it might stay open on subsequent startups of the app, it would not bring in any new mail. Peculiarly, although the techs that he talked with never indicated they had any, that this had any significance, the activity window in mail when open would show the getting mail bar full, but no progress was ever made and the process never completed, at least not to the point where the progress bars in the activity window would go away like normal. He talks about how he spent all kinds of time with Apple on the phone and Microsoft on the phone with all of them pointing at each other. We went through a couple of things. Actually, we didn't go through a couple of things. There are a couple of things I would go through here to troubleshoot this. The first would be simply removing the account from mail and adding it back in. But in that process, Office 365 lets you connect in two different ways. You can connect, as Ken is, with Exchange, and that's one protocol. And of course, they support that because Exchange is a Microsoft protocol. But you can also connect to Office 365 with IMAP, just straight IMAP. And in fact, Microsoft even has a support article that explains how to do that. That solved this for Ken. Better to say it worked around this for Ken. It's not the solution if you, for whatever reason, want to use Exchange, but it certainly solved it for him. And he gets his mail and reliably and without it crashing or using up gobs and gobs and gobs of RAM. So that was the solution here. I'm curious, though, if perhaps deleting that account and just re-adding it as an Exchange account would also have solved this problem. There are caches in mail that on the Mac, when you delete the account, they go away. And so that might be something here. There could have been some damage in a plist file or something in the settings for that account. So that's, but it worked. Removing it and re-adding it as IMAP worked. I think it might have worked if you removed it and re-added it as Exchange, but he wanted to be safer than sorry, and didn't really lose any functionality that he cared about going that way. So it's interesting stuff, man.
Yeah, we've had that come up in the past. Is just disabling mail and then turning it back on again is not sufficient to clear up a lot of especially mail crashes. You actually have to wipe it. You know, use the minus sign in the internet accounts or in the mail configuration screen when you set up the account. You actually have to get rid of it.
Yep.
And like you said, it clears out some cruft that caused it to crash.
Yep. Yep. All right. We have some other interesting troubleshooting stuff as always. And I'm looking for listener John because he says, I have a problem that's been with me for a few months. Whenever I try to back up my iPad Air 2 to my iTunes library, it errors out with a message that says iTunes could not back up because the iPad disconnected. I've been hoping for some magic fix in either OS 10 iTunes or iOS since August, but it's been a consistent problem. Of course, the device is not physically disconnecting. I've tried four different Lightning cables and both USB ports. I've tried it with and without a USB hub. Other USB devices have no issues. Also, previous iPhone 5 and now an iPhone 6S have no problems syncing with iTunes. This has been doing this since some version of iOS 8 and macOS 10.10x all the way through the updates to the latest iOS 10.11 and iTunes versions. One interesting thing, if I hit sync, it pops up this message within a few seconds. But if I hit OK, it actually continues and finishes the sync. However, if I hit backup, it pops up the error. I hit OK and it's done, but I have no backup. The last successful backup was August 14th, so it worked for the first 8 months or so of ownership. No, I haven't dropped it, and there was no trigger in the middle of August that I know of. All right, so this is interesting because it's obviously not having trouble communicating with the device if it can do a sync. The beginning of the sync, if it needs to, will trigger a backup. So that's what you're seeing, is you're getting this error anytime it tries to back up. Thankfully, even though it's having an error when you back up, it's still able to continue through and sync. I think the error message is misleading. In fact, I know it is because it's not disconnected, and nor does the system actually think it's disconnected. I think your backup for that device is corrupted. And it's trying to write to it and having some error, and it's just throwing up a dialogue, whatever dialogue it can kind of make sense of, but it's not making sense. But if you go into iTunes, go into preferences, go to devices, you'll see a list of all your backups there. Right click on what appears to be the active backup for that device, the one from August, and choose archive. The nice part about doing archive is it doesn't delete it, but it also moves it out of the way and essentially tells iTunes, we don't have a current backup for this one that you're supposed to update. Go create a brand new backup for this. And it renames it and actually gives the old one a date and time of the archive. It's very, very handy. But that, I think that'll do it for you. And it's a handy way to troubleshoot without blowing everything away. So that's my thoughts on that one. What do you think, John?
I'm curious. Yeah, I think I'm with you. Yeah, it probably is a corrupt thing. I'm curious if when you hook it up to iTunes, if it shows a recent iCloud backup.
I don't think he's backing up to iCloud. I think he's got too much stuff. He says, yeah, in fact, later in the email, he says, I suppose I could back up to iCloud, but I don't have enough free space there without paying the iCloud real estate tax. Yeah. So,
Ooh. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people that, you know, don't have enough space on iCloud for multiple devices to do backups. With five gigs isn't enough for most things. So,
yeah. I mean, the only other thought was that, you know, I mean, it sounds like it could be, and I think this was the suspicion as well. It does sound like a hardware issue. But, you know, he said he, you know, tried different cables and different ports and stuff like that. Just wondering, you know, if there's any cruft in the connector there, because I've had weird behavior like that with syncing my device.
Yeah.
And clearing whatever fuzz or whatever that gets stuck in the in my humble opinion poorly designed Lightning port.
Yeah they're especially, well, with an iPad that's less likely than a phone, which, you know, you're just putting in your pocket with all the lint. But yeah, it's a Lightning port, so yep, it can get, just when you're going to clean it out, use a wooden or plastic toothpick. Do not use a metal paperclip, because I don't know, I mean, people have and it works fine, but it's like playing the game Operator, right? You got to be really careful you got to be really careful going in there that, you know, you don't touch the sides with your metal thing and short something that you don't want to short. You don't want to let the magic smoke out.
Right.
Okay. While we're on the subject of iTunes backups, Bob has a related question. He says, I've got an iMac with a 256 gig SSD and multiple external drives where I store my iTunes and photos libraries and some documents. On my home drive, I just have OS 10, 10, 11, 2 and apps, but with multiple iOS devices, the mobile sync folder where the backups are stored has filled to the point where I cannot backup my new iPad Pro. I thought I could just move this backup folder to an external drive and use an alias to it, but iTunes just shows an error and would not backup at all. Any ideas on how I can relocate these backups to free up my OS drive? Yeah, this is one of those things that Apple should really let you do in the interface. You were really, really close, Bob, with doing it with an alias. Unfortunately, an alias doesn't work, but a symbolic link, which, for all intents and purposes to us humans, looks and acts just like an alias. A symbolic link is what you need. I'll put an article in the show notes from our friends at DigiDNA, the makers of iMazing, that explains how to relocate this folder. You do have to do some stuff in the terminal, but it's not that bad. Really, what you're doing is moving the backups folder to your external drive by copying it there and then deleting it from your local drive. And then you make in this case, a symbolic link, which is very much like an alias. You just have to do a terminal command to create it instead of doing it in the Finder. And you point the folder on the external drive to the location where it previously existed on your Mac's boot drive. And then the OS honestly has no idea that it's not just filling the backups folder on your boot drive. It just happens to be linking it elsewhere. So that's the trick. That's my trick anyway. Have you done this, John? I've done this. I have my backup stored externally because I don't want to.
Really?
Of course. I run my current machine, and my last machine actually has a 512 gig SSD in it. And then I've got connected, actually it's a Seagate Backup Plus with 4 terabytes external connected to the machine. And it's connected via USB 3. And I've got it partitioned so I can do my clones on that thing. And then I also just have, I think I have a 1 terabyte partition where I'm doing clones and some other stuff. And then, and that way it has plenty of room for carbon copy cloners, whatchamacallit, the safety net, which is good. And then I just have 3 terabytes of wide open space in my iTunes mobile backup folder lives over there now. And I'd have a symbolic link. It's exactly what we're talking about here. Works great. And then, you know, that way you're not messing with your SSD when you're doing that.
Yeah. Never thought of doing that.
Yeah.
Cause I got plenty of space on this machine. So yeah. I got 1 terabyte, but Though it is interesting, you may ask yourself, where are my backups? How do you know? And actually, here's a little quick tip here. So there are a few things that you can do in iTunes. So if you go to the, and it's in the same area, but to add a little to what you said before, Dave.
Sure.
So if you go to iTunes Preferences Devices, you're going to see the backups for your device. And there are a few other things you can do in this window. One, if you hover over a backup and wait a few moments, it will then show you all sorts of fun additional data about the device. So, for example, I hover over John F. Braun's iPhone 6S, and it'll show me, if I hover my cursor over that, it'll say, oh, well, here's your phone number, here's your IMEI, which you may need if you're having phone problems. There's the MEID, which is another, you know, serial number type of value. And then I think there's a final value there. But also if you, and the serial number of the device too. So hovering over the backup shows you additional information then, as you suggested. So if you right click on a backup, there are a few options. Now you mentioned, of course, there's the archive option or the delete option. Well, there's also show and finder in case you want to see where the backups are actually stored.
Yeah, good point. Oh, yeah. I like it.
And then it brings it up in the Finder. And, you know, if you click on the place that it brings you in the Finder, and here's another kind of quick tip. So if you see a folder at the top of a window in the Finder and you, I believe it's option click on it, it will show you the hierarchy of where things are buried. Because, for example, you know, when I say show me where my backups are, well, it shows me a folder called backup. It's like, OK, well, where's that? Well,
right, where's that? Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's actually in, so then you hold down the option key. So it's actually in my home folder, library, application, support, mobile sync, backup is actually where it lives.
You know,
so
that's a handy thing.
Backups.
I for whatever reason, I seem to have a mental block in remembering where that is. I mean, I know it's in home, library, and then it's like, is it in application support or is it somewhere else? And I, for whatever reason, I can never remember this. I remember everything else, right? You know, but not, I remember like the VIN number of my first car, but I can't remember this. But this is great because this, I don't have to. I can just go into iTunes and do show and finder and it'll bring me there. And now I know where it is. I like it. It's good. All right. Well, time for some El Capitan stuff, I think, John.
Oh, boy.
No, it's, before we get into this, I want to say, For me, at least on the two devices, actually, I'm running it on many. The family's all running it on theirs, the machines they use. But on the two that I on the two El Capitan machines I have, I still haven't upgraded the studio to El Capitan. I'll probably do that sometime, you know, after CES, late January. I always wait on this because with audio hardware, I have no rush, right? But on the two machines that I'm running it on, my MacBook Air and my Retina iMac, it's fantastic. It's been like smooth sailing. Mail has been reliable. It doesn't have these weird lags anymore. It's been panacea for me, you know, and I should find some wood to knock on here because I know what that's like. But that doesn't mean that you folks aren't having issues with it. And obviously we're here to help. But I did just want to point out that, you know, with all my kvetching about what I went through with Yosemite, that El Capitan truly has been fantastic. But That fact doesn't help Bill.
I've had a little, some weirdness. So I haven't had kernel panics. I did under, and I think most were related to the Wi-Fi in Yosemite. So I haven't had a kernel panic. The only weird thing, I think I've had it happen twice, and I'm not sure if it's the OS or if it's something that I installed, but I've had like one or two situations where I just get blown out of the OS and back to the login screen. And I'm like,
wow.
How did I get here? I don't think I hit any key combination that logged me out, though I think there is one if you want to do that. I think there's a keyboard shortcut to do that. But yeah, all of a sudden I'm, you know, I see, you know, my the login and a password prompt, and I'm like, okay. And I do that and it's like, you know, I'm logging in again. You know, it loads all my reloading all my, things in the menu bar and stuff like that. I've only had it happen once or twice. And I think one time, I think it was after an OS update, I rebooted my machine and I got vertical bars, alternating vertical bars, black and white. and it just sat there. And that's a situation where I actually had to use the tip that was given earlier, which is the hold down the power button for 5 seconds.
Right.
But then I restarted and everything was ducky. So, yeah, but also I'll say, yeah, a lot more stable. No kernel panics.
That's good.
And you know, have you ever had that? But I have had that rarely on different versions of OS X, where it just blows you out to the, OS.
I've seen it, but not with any frequency or regularity. No, that's frightening. I mean, it's what that is, I believe, is Windows Server dying. I believe that's what that is. But that, I mean, it doesn't mean it's good, but that's what it is.
You know what it could be also? Now, it's funny. I actually read this one, a Twitter account, and it's actually kind of funny. I don't know if you follow it. Swift on Security.
No, but I'll put a link in the show notes.
Well, it's basically, you know, it has a picture of Taylor Swift. And it's an account that, so it's, you know, of course, it's not really Taylor Swift giving you IT security tips. But that account actually linked to a report that showed that RAM-based errors occur more frequently than you may think.
Huh.
And I'm wondering if that was what caused, you know, something like that, a RAM error that it just, you know, decided, well, I'll blow you out to the login screen.
Huh.
I'll have to dig up that report, but it was quite, it happens a lot more, and it could explain a lot of the weird things that we see happen.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course.
Is that RAM is not perfect, even with, you know, error correction and stuff, which I think typically Apple does not use error correction,
or
they don't like you using RAM with, I think it's ECC error correction code or something like that. I think they specifically say you really shouldn't, or they don't recommend that you use that type of memory in Macs.
That's it. Yeah, I believe it. I mean, yeah. Huh.
I have to find that report. It's good stuff. Kind of scary, actually.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. All right, let's, Bill had it, actually, and what's funny is the problem that Bill described is one that I had. He was trying to share some folders in OS X's file sharing. So he goes into system preferences, goes to sharing, goes to file sharing, turns it on, and then clicks to add a folder. And it lets him go and navigate. And he hits add, and nothing appears in the preference pane. And he hits add again, and nothing appears in the preference pane. Well, I went to test this. Like, that shouldn't happen. And I went to test it, and sure enough, I did it with 4 folders. Nothing appeared. So I posted to our Facebook group about this, and several people replied, and I don't have it open, and I can't tell you which one. But you should join our Facebook group, and then you'd know. Go to MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. That'll bring you there, and you'll see all this stuff. And yeah, like even we ask for help, right? Because it's why not? We have a great community of folks, and we're all here helping each other. And it took, you know, maybe an hour for somebody to say, oh, yeah, I've seen that before. Quit system preferences. Come back in, and all the options will be there. And sure enough, the 4 folders that I had added were right there. So it must be just a UI weirdness, you know, or maybe some plist file. I don't know. It persisted. I mean, it saved the things. I had to go and remove them because I didn't actually want to share those 4 folders that I had put in there. But it worked out. So Bill was also having some other weird issues. But I think Bill was trying to share a network folder as well. I think he was having this issue plus he was trying to share a network folder, which you can't do. You can share external drives. You can share internal drives. You can share subfolders of the aforementioned, but you cannot share network folders because if they're network folders, another computer should be able to get to them. And that's the logic there. But yeah, it was just, you know, weird stuff. So there you go. I have had one issue. I'm sure I've had more than one issue with El Capitan. But generally, it's been working out. Interesting stuff. And moving on to Larry. Larry has some questions about how to get to El Capitan. He says, I've been waiting a little bit to install it on my early 2008 Mac Pro. It was running fine with Yosemite, and I just wanted some of the features of El Capitan. Now, ever since installing it for a day, It's been running very slow, and I'm getting a ton of spinning color beach balls of death. The machine kind of died on me a few months back, and since I had just recently upgraded the graphics card so I can run Final Cut, I had the machine repaired. It was surprisingly only a few hundred bucks, and I got a bigger hard drive out of it. It has 6 gigs of RAM in it, so I have 4 empty. I found a reasonable deal on some excellent RAM totaling 16 gigs. Should I try that and get another year out of the computer and upgrade my RAM? I'm really not anxious to get a new computer right now. My laptop, my iPhone, and my iPad serve me very well, but I do like having the desktop for the heavy lifting stuff. There used to be a time when the day AppleCare expired, I was immediately buying a new machine, but this one has just been so reliable. And mind you, it was an AppleCare replacement for a PowerMac G4 that was replaced under AppleCare. If I buy a new Mac Pro, my only option is the new Black Tower, of course. And that means shelling out $3,000. I already have a 22-inch monitor that I'm very happy with. Any suggestions? Maybe I should try a clean install. And then actually, Larry went back to Yosemite and says it's running way slow on that machine, on that. Now, so here's the, and he asked, okay, so what's going on? So here's the thing. RAM will always help. It's never a bad idea to put more RAM in a machine. However, and we've said this a few times on the show, and John, you might actually disagree with me. Actually, I don't know where you fall on this, but with Yosemite and El Capitan, my feeling is an SSD is going to serve you way better than RAM will. Again, it's not that RAM is bad or even useless. It's not. It's very useful. But I think the issues you're seeing are twofold. Number one, Yosemite and El Capitan really, in our experience here, are not engineered to be efficient on. There's been no optimizations done to them to make them work well for on spindle drives. It doesn't mean that they won't. It's just that Apple's sort of kind of moved past that. I think they haven't told us this, obviously, but that's certainly been our experience and the experience that you folks have shared. So an SSD is what these OSs are kind of. That's the target for these. Additionally, and again, because you're on a spindle drive, you've now put two OSs on this drive, right? And so things are very fragmented out there, especially if the drive was full. So you're trying to, you know, you put El Capitan on, that's a lot of new data that's been kind of jumbled around on this drive. And then you put Yosemite back. Again, a lot of new data. You're not running the same Yosemite that you used to. You can solve this. You can defragment your drive. OS X does some level of defragmentation. I think that whole hot files thing is still there in Yosemite and Mavericks, but maybe, Yosemite and El Capitan, but maybe it's not. I don't know if hot file management is still there, which was Apple's sort of loose or lightweight defragmentation. It would do some files, but you can use something like Drive Genius 4 now. Has a defragmenter in it, and you can run that, or you can clone the drive off to something else and clone it back, and that sort of has a de facto defragmenting effect because you're wiping out the drive and just putting files back on it. But I think the fragmentation of your drive is what you're seeing, and you also have to remember when you put a new OS on a drive, it can take, especially on a spindle drive where it takes longer to do read and write operations. It can take a day or two for everything, you know, certainly a day or an overnight for everything to all the, you know, new spotlight indexes and mail indexes and all of that stuff to finish building. So I think an SSD would serve you very well on that machine is where I'm going with this. RAM's not bad. Put it in if you've got it. But I think you'll see more of a difference out of an SSD. Mr. Braun.
I'm wondering. I looked this up. I actually got to see if this may be an optional command here, but I actually did find a reference to hot file clustering and further in the there's an article that suggests a command you can run to see which files have been clustered, if you will. But I don't have. It's something called HFS debug. I think I may have to install that. That may be part of the developer tools or something.
Okay.
But I do have an article that's who wrote this here? It's a OS X Oh, well, it was a book written in 2004.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that hot file clustering has been active for several OSs. I'm doing some quick Google searching. I didn't do this research ahead of the show, but it seems there's people reporting that kind of since Snow Leopard, it's been, you know, used less. I'm not convinced of that. I thought it was pretty active in Snow Leopard, but wouldn't surprise me if it was gone now. Again, you know, I just don't think it's being engineered. The OSs are being engineered for that. That's, I don't know.
I mean, the only thing I'd suggest for slowdowns is you may want to fire up Onyx or maintenance.
Yeah.
It's little brother. Specifically, there's a cleaning section, and there's a system in a user area, and that basically deletes some caches. You may have some stale or old caches, so cleaning some of those out may speed things up. A corrupt or bad cache can always could cause slowdowns.
Absolutely.
That's my suggestion.
That's true. Yeah, although, you know, a new OS should start with fresh caches. I mean, one of the things is the cache folders are literally wiped out during or just simply not populated.
You should.
Agreed. But that's the thing is should. Right. I don't know. I don't know. That's my feeling. SSD. Just to kind of wrap this one up, John, I want to ask you a question. And when we're looking for, you know, a relatively quick answer, is if in Larry's case, would you recommend RAM first or SSD first?
I'd say an SSD.
Yeah. All right. Good. Sweet. So we're in agreement here on this one. All right.
If you don't have enough RAM, you're going to swap. But the thing is, an SSD will make everything faster, including swapping. So, I would say overall, you're going to get better. If you had to choose between the two, what to spend money on, I would say an SSD. Unless you have a pathetically small amount of RAM, like, you know, 2 gigs or 4 gigs or something.
Hey, man, I'm running 4 gigs in a 2011 MacBook Air and with an SSD, though. I mean, that's the important part. And I don't think I notice the fact that it's what I would consider light on RAM, because 4 gigs is, you know, light on RAM. But I can't upgrade it, at least not without, you know, a soldering iron, probably. I should look into that and see if anybody's kind of figured out a simple upgrade, or maybe I should just get a new Air. So,
well, I thought some of the Airs, it's like an eSATA or some. I thought some of them you could.
You can upgrade the SSD some of them, yes. but not the RAM.
Not the RAM.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The days of updating RAM are over.
Are over. Yeah.
Or user serviceable RAM.
Right.
Are over.
Right. All right. I want to talk about our second batch of sponsors here, John, if that's okay with you.
Splendid.
All right. BB Edit is a piece of software that I use literally every day. I'll use it as soon as we finish this episode to clean up the chapter markers and the show notes before putting those in. And then, of course, John takes them from there and also uses BB Edit to lovingly handcraft the rest of the show notes with the timings and all of that great stuff. BB Edit makes all of this stuff really easy. It can be as geeky or not geeky as you want it to be. Geeky stuff, of course, includes coding things like HTML or stuff that's even far geekier than that. I use it for PHP all the time. You can use it to code JavaScript. You can use it to code CSS. It's smart enough to know what language you're in and starts highlighting the text in appropriate ways. It doesn't change the text. The text on the disk or on your server remains clean, but it highlights it visually, just for you, while you're editing. Makes life super easy. You can also do word counts, character counts, all of that stuff. Here's the thing. For a limited time, you can get BB Edit for $39.99. It's normally $49.99, right? It's normally $50. Now you can get it for $40. Part of their Winterfest 2015 discount. There's actually a promotion for many app vendors that have partnered together to do this. You don't have to do anything special. Just go to barebones.com, go to the store, go to buy BB Edit, and boom, BB Edit 11, the price shows up. It's $39.99. It's right there. Check it out. Barebones.com. Our thanks to Barebones and BB Edit for sponsoring this episode. I also want to thank lynda.com at lynda.com/MGG for sponsoring this episode. That's the URL you go to get 10 days of free training videos for you. This is a fantastic site. After that, it's only $25 a month. That's where the plans start. And you get access to everything, both during your 10 days free and just for $25 a month. These courses are fantastic. Things like Pro Tools 12 Essential Training, right? With Sky Lewin. This is a 10-hour course that they've produced just for you. And you get to stop it and start it and rewind and check the notes, everything. It's all perfect. But then they've got things like, are you a photographer? Maybe you want to learn photography from people like Ben Long or Photos. They have a course called Photos for OS 10 Essential Training with Derek Story. If there is anyone out there that is like the authority on this stuff, it's Derek Story. He's the man when it comes to this stuff. Pixel Playground with Burt Monroy. These are rock stars that they get to do these training videos just for you. Super well produced, brilliant stuff, totally easy. And there's thousands, literally thousands of videos available at Lynda. Every time I go in here to look, to tell you about Lynda, I'm finding courses that are brand new stuff. It's just constant. You got to check it out. Lynda.com. That's lynda.com/MGG. That's where you go to get 10 days of this for free. And then after that, plans start at $25 a month. And that really gets you everything. There's no catch. You just have it all. Check it out. Lynda.com/MGG. Our thanks to Lynda for sponsoring this episode. All right. And now I think we should stick with the upgrade stuff here, John, because it gets interesting and it's time, you know. Kevin writes that he has a mid 2011 27-inch iMac, sorry, with a hard drive that is showing signs of going bad. He's got periodic clicking, freezes followed by kernel panics. It says Apple Disk Utility and Onyx say the drive is okay, but he's been around drives long enough. He doesn't trust it anymore. And that's smart. He says, I have backups of my machine, so no worries there. Kevin continues, I'm thinking about proactively replacing the drive as I'd like to get several more years out of this machine. I already have access to both a 120 gig SSD and my choice of 1 or 2 terabyte hard drives. So I was thinking about buying iFixit's dual drive hard kit for $50 and following the instructions to mount the SSD behind the optical drive and then replace the hard drive so that I would have an SSD, a hard drive, and the optical drive. With a brand new SSD and hard drive in the machine, I would probably be unable to resist the temptation to set them up as a fusion drive. I believe I recall that in more than one past episode of the podcast, Dave's talked about replacing the parts on the iMac. I've asked some of my friends and some say go for it. It's more intimidating than difficult, while others say it's worth paying someone else. He says, of course, another possibility is attaching the SSD and or hard drive to the iMac externally. But since it's only got USB 2, that would be slower than I'd like. And Thunderbolt adapters and or drives are pricey, especially since I already have the SSD and hard drive and would only be out for the kit. And he says he actually wound up going with the Otherworld Computing kit. We got a little follow up from him. So, yeah. My thoughts on this. If it were my machine, I'd be tempted to put both drives in and go the fusion drive route. Equally though, I'd be tempted to put the SSD into boot from, but I'd probably go with a larger SSD. But you have them already, and I get that, right? But, you know, a 120 gig SSD, listen, it's bigger than the one that Apple is putting in some of their Fusion Drive machines right now. But you know, it's certainly big enough to do a Fusion Drive with. And people have had good luck with the Fusion Drives. But with the price of SSDs, and the fact that you don't want to be cracking this thing open all the time, you know, I don't know. I'd certainly look and price out some larger SSDs and possibly go that route. Opening up the machine, I like what the way you described what your friend said, that it's more intimidating than difficult. That's true. But I will share a piece of advice from longtime listener Dave Cook here, who unfortunately had a bad experience. He had seen somewhere, you know, with these iMacs, you know, you've got to take the glass off the front. I've always followed, and I've always done this following instructions, and thankfully, I guess the only instructions I've seen are that you put two suction cups on the screen, one in, you know, kind of opposite corners from each other. You put the screen down on, you know, put the iMac down on its back so the screen is face up, and you just lift straight up. That's worked very well for me. Unfortunately, Dave wrote in that he had found some instructions that said to put like a something in the edge to kind of lift the machine up. And he did that and then needed to get better angle on the machine and wound up putting too much pressure on whatever he had put in the edge and cracked the screen. Obviously, that's not the desired outcome. So get the suction cups and use the suction cups. They work well. I typically leave the screen, you know, I create like another towel. I put a towel down before I pull the screen off, and you know, with the 27-inch iMac, you might need two towels. I don't, you know, it depends on how you lay it all out. But I lift it off and I put it down on the towel, and then I make sure that it's not somewhere where I'm going to randomly like put things on the screen, because obviously you don't want to do that because it'll either scratch or crack it. But yeah, it's not difficult getting in there once you pull the screen off. And pulling the screen off is easy, but you know, once you get through that, it's really a simple kind of thing to dig into these. It's not too bad at all. We've done it many, many times. Both my kids have helped me. My daughter actually really likes it. She's a total pro at digging in. So yeah, but the Fusion Drive with 120, you know, if you got a 2 terabyte hard drive and 120 gig SSD, I got Fusion Drive. What would you do, John?
The first thing I would do, well, I like, out of technical curiosity, so I've done this in the past. Actually, I've proactively replaced the hard drive in my TiVo more than once when I suspected it was failing.
Sure.
And like most devices, the thing is the TiVo actually has a secret handshake where you can run drive diagnostics. I don't know why it doesn't do it automatically, or maybe the latest one does. I'm still stubbornly holding on to my TiVo Series 3, which they're starting to take away more and more features.
I thought you bought a Romeo.
I was considering it. They keep rolling out refurbished Romeo deals.
Yeah.
With Lifetime.
I was going to say this at the end of the show, but next week we're going to talk about TiVos, and I thought we would compare your new Romeo to the Bolt that I'm testing, because I just finally got the Bolt set up yesterday, so I'm not quite ready to talk about it. I want to have some experience with it before we talk about it in the show. But okay, well, you've done some research on the Romeo, so I want to compare these two, because it's weird what TiVo has done with their product line. It's like weirdly bifurcated. The Bolt and the Romeo each have things that are better than the other, but we'll talk about it, because it gets really cool with what you can do with iOS now with those devices. So we'll talk, but that's next.
And
episode.
It's becoming less cool because, for example, I used to be able to go online and log into my TiVo and schedule things.
Yeah.
They removed that ability, at least for the Series 3.
Oh, I can still do it with the Premiere. Right.
They're starting to pull features away to really convince you, you know, hey, John, you know, get off of the
it's time.
Series 3, dude.
Yeah, yeah. That's weird.
Romeo
we have...
is the baseline. I think the Romeo is now the basic unit if you expect to get any sort of a advanced functionality.
Well, let's defer this. I don't want to get too deep here because we're going to do this next week, so I don't want to do it 2 weeks in a row. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the only thing I would do out of technical curiosity, similar to what I did on the TiVo, is I actually ran a smart diagnostic, and then it came up and said, oh, yeah, this drive is starting to go. But you may want to, on that drive, just determine what's causing the problem here, is that you can run, and I'm going to plug this one to it. So I still use something called Smart Reporter. Now, Smart Reporter is nice because it lets you run kind of an extended smart report, in that the drive keeps track of all sorts of, you know, terrible things that happens to it, and it keeps a running total of the bad things that are happening, and you can access that either through something like Smart Reporter, or they actually have a website where you can go directly. So he uses actually a third party library to do this. And if you go to www.smartmontools.org, you can access this library. And I think you can probably get it through a package manager too.
Cool.
But I'm with you. Yeah. Proactively replace it.
My TiVo Premiere needs a new drive too. It's been really flaky lately, but I've been, since I set up the Bolt yesterday, I've just been blasting over my network, all the stuff that's on it over. So even once I have to send the Bolt back, I'll be able to wipe out my original TiVo and, you know,
and I'd be, you know, you should try. There's a page that tells you how to get into the testing page.
Yeah, I wanted to get data before I started testing things. I was getting nervous.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Good idea. Because mine actually, the symptom where I thought it was the drive going is that the unit would just randomly restart. It's like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that? While I was watching, you know, recorded content.
That's bad.
I guess it came on a bad block. But I guess I'm with you.
Cool.
As to what to do on that machine here. Yep. Just watch sharp edges. That's my only caution. I helped our pal Duffy upgrade the drive in an iMac at one point.
Yep. And did you get cut?
If I wasn't careful, yeah.
Yeah.
I
mean,
there's a sharp metal edge and a sharp glass edge when you pull the screen out. Just watch it. Mm-hmm. I know people that have cut themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will share my tip again, because we're talking about taking apart a computer. Go to iFixit, print out their instructions. And yes, you want to have them printed so that you're not relying on something electronic to continue displaying them. And the benefit when you print them is if you have a roll of Scotch tape handy, you can take the screws from each step and tape them to the page upon which they matter. And then you just, you know, fold through all your pages. And when you're going backwards through to put it back together, because that's how iFixit's instructions work, they don't give you the put it back together instructions. They just say, now go from the end forward. You have your screws at exactly the right time and you never screw it up. Ha ha. No pun intended. So listener John writes, he said, I've been a user of Handbrake for a very long time, archiving my DVDs. I would like to do the same for my Blu-rays. I heard you guys mention before on the show, is it as easy as just buying a USB Blu-ray drive and going through the same Handbrake routine? I've heard that the Mac will not play Blu-ray back natively, but my usage would be over Plex or Apple TV. And actually, once you've ripped the file, then as long as you rip it into a format that a Mac will play, your Mac will play it. However, it's not quite as simple as getting a USB Blu-ray drive and plugging it in and just magically having it work with Handbrake. There is one more thing you need to do, and that I use MakeMKV typically for this. There's other programs, and actually I've tested a lot of them. The stuff from the folks at DigiArty works really well, believe it or not. Or maybe you would believe it. But that, yeah, I like that. I like the Mac X DVD Ripper Pro. You can also do it with Make MKV. If you like Handbrake and you're comfortable with it, go get Make MKV. I'll put a link in the towers. I don't know why I keep calling it that. We call our chat room for TMO. We call it the TMO Towers, but I don't know why I'm calling it. I'll put a link in the show notes and of course in our chat room to an article I wrote actually a couple of years ago about doing exactly this. And it talks through getting Make MKV and how to make it work so that there's a library that comes with Make MKV and you can link it together in a way that Handbrake will just natively read from a Blu-ray and rip it directly. It works in probably 90% of the discs that I've tried. And if it doesn't, then you can just rip the disc with Make MKV to an MKV file, and then you can convert that with Handbrake. Or if you want to get really, really geeky, you can be like me. What I do is I rip the Blu-ray with Make MKV. That makes effectively a lossless version of the data on the Blu-ray. And then it's using Handbrake, but I use Don Melton, former Apple Safari engineer, crazy movie guy, likes to have movies that are approximately the same quality as iTunes. And you can do all this with Handbrake, But Don has figured out all the scripts, and there's, depending on how the movie's set up, there's different ways you want to use Handbrake to do it. Don has automated that process, and he's got some scripts that you can use. I'll put a link in the show notes to those. You've got to use them from the terminal. There's no GUI for it. It uses Handbrake from the CLI, and you need Brew or some other package manager to install all the kind of related things. But the movies that it makes have great sound. They put the subtitles in perfectly. It's beautiful quality, just like iTunes, which, yes, is compressed, but not overly so. So, you can totally do it. It's fun. I say it's fun. Yeah, it's fun. But if you just want to do it with Handbrake and the GUI, you can do that too.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have I got a Blu-ray player. I don't have a drive for, maybe I should.
So here's the thing, John.
Because I assume Blu-ray has the same copy protection silliness that DVDs do.
Similar, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so you can't just copy the video file off of it. Okay.
No. But in that article that I've linked to, I have a link to the Blu-ray reader that I use, which is still available at Amazon. I think it's $43 and $43.50. So I'll put that link separately in the show notes as well. It's, it works great. I've had it for years and ripped countless movies with it, and it just works. So, cheap and worth
actually,
it.
I wonder,
actually more than worth it.
You know what? I wonder if I can hook up the one I have in my house that I use to watch them. I wonder if I can hook that up to the computer. I may have to build an interface. I don't think it has an interface on it.
Huh. Yeah, right. If you can, build an interface. I wonder if a Raspberry Pi would be the easiest way to kind of, get to the middle of that. I don't know. Do you have a Raspberry Pi yet?
No, I know what they are. Yeah, it's a little computer, right?
Right.
Do all sorts of projects. It runs, Linux, I guess?
Yeah, well, it runs whatever you want it to run. But yeah, Linux is what most people put on them. But I mean, you can get them cheap. I mean, it's like whatever, somewhere between like $20 and $50. And you can do all kinds of cool stuff. You got to, I'm shocked you don't have one to tinker with. It seems like perfect. But for reading Blu-rays on your Mac, $43.50, Amazon Prime, you'll have it before Christmas. You're good to go.
Yeah. But someone said, just spend the $43, John.
That's
right. Come on, man. If I can save $43 and get a little project going, I'm going to get a little project
going.
That's
true. I'm with you on that. Yeah, the project.
It's just curiosity.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if the one that I have, which is it's a Sylvania, which is actually made, it's not really Sylvania, or someone else makes it.
Yeah,
I forget. But when I upgraded the firmware one time, I actually found out the real maker of it.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's like a USB or other interface on the circuit board, and I just have to, maybe get a cable or something.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Well, like I had to do with my routers when I, put a bad build of a firmware on or something, and they're totally bricked. Most routers, believe it or not, I haven't tried this with the Apple ones, of course, but most third-party routers, and certainly the Buffalo ones that I have a jumper block on them with four pins that is a serial port, but there's no port.
JTAG?
Well, yeah. And so, exactly. So I have a USB to serial adapter that I bought on Amazon for, I don't know, $10 or something. And I use OS X screen to, in the terminal to connect to it. And I can talk to my router over a serial connection and get it back to life every time, which is, it's fun. I had to make notes because I only have to do it like once every 6 months. And it's like, oh yeah, because if you put the wrong cable in the wrong spot, you'll send 5 volts to the wrong place and blow it up. So you got to make sure you don't do that. But it works really well. It's got like send, receive, ground, and power, I guess, is the four ports on it. So it's fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's JTAG.
That's right.
That's pretty much a standard for interfacing to circuit boards.
Yeah, no, that's totally what it's called.
Emulators.
Yeah.
Fun stuff.
Yeah, Joint Test Action Group is what JTAG stands for.
Nice.
Yeah, I didn't know until just now when I was searching for it. Hey, while we're at it, and I'm enjoying my caffeine today. I like these morning shows when I'm allowed to have caffeine. It's good. It's not often, though. Peter has a related tip here. He said, I'm a new listener, really enjoying your show. I've been ripping my Lord of the Rings movies to put them on my Plex. The DVD versions of these are the extended versions, so each movie is on two discs. When I finish ripping, I end up with two M4V files for each movie, which is exactly what you get if you use any of the permutations of the previous tip we discussed. He says, and this is where it gets brilliant. I never thought to do this. You Unix geeks out there are either going to know this or you're going to go, whoa. There's a cat command in the terminal that is used to basically just take the contents of a file and either display it on the screen or send it out to another file or a device or whatever you want. And he says, I've used the cat command in the terminal to join two text files in the past, and I wondered if it would work for M4V files. It did. So he says you do cat space, you know, movie file part 1.m4v space movie file part 2.m4v space, and then the greater than sign, which says take the output of the previous stuff and dump it into whatever's next. And after the greater than sign, he says, you know, movie file whole.m4v. And it done. It just works. I never knew. I mean, this is, it must just be something about the M4V standard that lets the things that play it back. He says Plex doesn't have a problem with it. Apple TV doesn't have a problem with it. QuickTime doesn't have a problem. It just plays them. And the movies just roll right together. It's brilliant. I couldn't believe it, that it worked. So simple. Cat is probably older than both of us, John. Certainly, if it's not, it's close. So I love it.
Yeah, thank it's you, interesting. I've only used it, and I think most, to display a file on the screen. You know, cat and then the file, and then it throws it to standard output.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, I was scratching my head because, based on that experience, my conclusion would be, oh, well, it only really deals with text, right?
Exactly.
The answer is no, it deals with
whatever you want.
And I guess the M4V, I'm curious, I bet you it would work probably with some other, if whoever came up with the file format for things like, I'm curious if it would work with MP3s or AIFS or some audio files too.
Oh, yeah.
It would depend. I mean, now that I'm thinking, if you're designing, so what M4V must have is that each, every now and then it has, metadata, telling the player about the file, and it doesn't have to be
right.
At the beginning.
It doesn't all have to be at the beginning. Correct. Yeah.
Because I think some file formats would fail on that because you
well, that's what I figured. It's a container, right? And that's what M4V is it's a container. So it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I guess, like you said, yeah, whoever wrote the codec said, and it's okay if there's another container here. Just play it. Yeah. I think it's pretty cool. Yeah, I want to try it with an MP3. That's a good point. Yeah.
Or even graphics. I'm wondering if you tried it with an image file, if it would smash them together or what you'd get.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're all containers in that together. Sense, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'll have to try it with some photos or something.
As Alex
smashes them together or it's just a mess.
As Alex in our chat room says, cat the Stitcher. Yep, there it is. I like it. And it does. It stitches things together unceremoniously, too. Just works.
We should have a cat room.
We should. we're on to geeky tips, so let's wrap up the show with at least one more, maybe two. Robert actually has a really good geeky tip for us. He writes, I will find it here. I swear I'll find it. He says, I still have to use a PC occasionally, and I've set up a virtualized environment using Oracle's VirtualBox on my Macs. Since I have several Macs, I like to be able to remotely log into my virtual PC from one of my other Macs. For cross-platform remote access, I use TeamViewer normally, but for PCs, I prefer using Microsoft's RDP protocol based on tools like Microsoft's remote or third-party RDP clients because Microsoft's RDP protocol is very fast and the most native way to connect to Windows machines. This is especially useful for logging in from iOS to a remote PC, either real or virtual. I found TeamViewer and other solutions to be sometimes flaky or slow. And I agree, Microsoft's RDP on iOS is awesome. One of the bummers of using virtual PCs is dealing with all the licensing issues. I had used one of my licenses to upgrade from Windows 7 to Windows 10, so I have a fully licensed Windows 10 virtual machine in my VirtualBox PC, but unfortunately, remote desktop capability is not supported in Windows Home Edition. You have to upgrade to Windows Pro for $99. Just to clarify, the server portion of RDP is not included in Windows Home. The client is there, so you can reach out to other remote PCs, but you cannot connect back to a home PC without upgrading it to Pro. He says, but I found an awesome solution, VirtualBox extensions, which are also free. So VirtualBox is free. VirtualBox extensions are free. Include a virtual RDP server in the VirtualBox host. So you can remotely connect to VirtualBox using RDP, no matter what version or even type of OS is running. The trick is that you set up your RDP client to connect to the IP address of the Mac, not the IP of the virtualized box. And there he goes. He said, I don't know if Parallels or VMware has this capability. They kind of do with Parallels Access and that sort of thing, but I don't think like this. So very cool. I had no idea. I got to dig more into VirtualBox. You recommend it to me all the time, John. And because I have Parallels and VMware, I just haven't dug into them. But it seems like this is interesting. I like it. It's good stuff.
And they still, yep. And it's still there. I remember using a Mac in the workplace, which was mostly PC based, but we were all very happy when Microsoft said, oh, well, here's a Mac version of remote desktop connection.
Yeah.
And they still have it.
Yes.
And they still do. Have it installed on my machine. I haven't had to use it for a while because I don't really have much of a need these days to connect to Windows servers, but I used to, but I still have it.
Yeah. And it works on iOS. They have an iOS client as well that works really well.
Oh,
yeah. I
didn't know that.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't be too much fun on the iPhone, though.
I've done it.
Probably okay on the iPad.
Yeah, well, you know.
Oh, sure, it'll work. It'd just be puny.
Well, that's one of the reasons I really like the 6S is for remote access to things. I regularly use the 6S to use, like I go VNC back to my Mac using, like, Screens, the iOS app called Screens. And I'm able to control my Mac just fine with it. It works well. One time recently, I was doing something in iTunes. Oh, I got all excited when Apple upped the limit from 25,000 tracks to 100,000 tracks for iCloud Music Library and iTunes Match that I wanted to. We were on our way to a hockey game. Lisa was driving. And so I logged in with Screens because I wanted to tell it to update because I had a ton of files that it wouldn't update with the 25,000 song limit. And it did. I got the update started, and by the time we got back, everything was good, and Apple Music was happy, which makes my Sonos happy now, and it's all, like, life is blissful with Apple Music. It really, really is. But the next day, I went into my office, and actually, I went to get in my car, which is in the garage right next to my office, and my son was like, hey, you know, there's music playing in your office. In fact, it was playing here last night when I got back from the hockey game, and I thought, oh, yeah, I must have accidentally, like, tapped the play button or double tapped a file, and it just started playing files and it played music all night. But, you know, things could be worse. So one last geeky tip, I think, is what we have time for, John. And this comes from Mark. He says, in a recent episode, you had a discussion about tools for manipulating image EXIF metadata. There is one tool you didn't mention. It's the ultimate geek tool. It's a Perl library called EXIF tool. It's available online. He gave us a link. I'll not provide information about using the tool. Geeks with Perl skills will know. Others need to study and practice. He says, be careful. Perl is like a table saw. It can help build beautiful furniture or cut off your fingers in a careless moment. So we'll put a link to EXIF tool out there. Thanks for sharing that, Mark.
That's fun. Sounds just like C.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, that's, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, being a C programmer, the nice thing, the one thing I like about C is that you can do almost anything you want.
Yeah.
Including, you know, screwing around with hardware.
Sure.
The bad news about C is it'll let you do whatever, because it assumes you know what you're doing.
So, right. Yeah,
similar to.
Right. I'm trying to think.
I'm wondering.
Does Homebrew have EXIF tool? It does. Yep. So you could do.
Well, I'm looking right.
Brew install EXIF tool. You're good to go.
There it is. Okay. And I'm looking in Fink and I see a few references. Here's one, image-exif tool- PM? Oh, okay. So that's the Perl vert. All right.
Yeah, that's it. Yep. Cool. All right. I'm trying to think. Is there anything else? Yeah, you know what? We've got one more geeky tip and we're right here. We're going to go ahead and do it. Ernie, this is where it gets really geeky, but fun. He says, I know you guys run crash plan on your Synology NAS units. I've been using the Synology packages that are available from a third party, which I think you use too. And that's true. That's what I use for crash plan. He says, lately though, the crash plan version has been changing so much that it's been broken more often than it's working because the updates are a little bit painful. The folks that create the package have done a heroic job keeping it up to date, but I figured there must be a better way. I stumbled across Docker, which is a thing that's new in Synology's Distation Manager 5, which is available for everybody, although you need to have a fast enough CPU to use Docker. He says, I found a person who had created a Docker container for CrashPlan. Docker essentially lets you run virtual installations of an OS or apps or both on your disk station that you access remotely. So this gets very, very cool. And he sent us a link, which we'll put in the show notes. He says it works on relatively decent Intel hardware. He says he has a DS412 Plus, which is a almost 4-year-old unit with only 2 gigs of RAM, and it's been running for a few weeks just great. The recent update of Crash Plan 4.5 went flawlessly, and I didn't have to do a thing. It just happened. So this is essentially running Crash Plan inside a Windows environment, I believe, or maybe it's a Unix environment. It could be either on Synology, but it's inside a container. It's a virtual environment. That's what these Docker things are, is they're built to be app-specific. So very cool stuff. He says the Docker instance did require a little command line work, and it also required installing the Docker package, but that's available inside Synology. So we'll put the link and the instructions. Probably a better way to do crash plan on your disk station than the previous way. So thank you for that. Fun stuff. I like it. It's
even more fun stuff, Dave.
What's that?
I had a need to get a Synology package, or I was looking for a package for Synology and it wasn't available in their standard list of packages.
Yeah. That, which is and what the crash plan thing I use is you have to install a third party library or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And I actually, so I have a couple listed here. I'll have to find some more. There are good sources, third party sources. And so if you go on your Synology package center and then community, they then have a place where you can, you basically give it a URL for a third party. And actually,
I'll put a link to
that. I have here that seems to have the most is packages.synocommunity.com.
That's right. Yeah.
That was one where I found a lot. But there are a whole bunch of others. That one, from what I can tell, seems to have the most that are. It's kind of nice that Synology also, you know, opens that up to make it easy for third parties to make their software available.
I'll share a screenshot to my links to all the ones that I use.
I only got two. Okay. Yeah. That'd be nice to get a good list. Cause some of them were kind of hard to find. They don't advertise well.
Yep. Yep. Hopefully I'm not divulging anything I shouldn't, but I don't think I am. Hopefully I'm not like divulging my, not necessarily my home IP, but you know, anyway, I'll put it in the show notes.
I know your home IP.
I know. It's not that big of a deal. We're pretty secured here. But security by obscurity is even better.
Yeah.
People don't know you're there. Well, they don't try to hack you.
Yeah. Oh, I suppose you could. Did I do this? I think I turned this off on my router. You can make your router not respond to pings.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes it less likely for people to tell that you're there. Not impossible.
It's right.
It'll discourage. I think I did a security scan and it said, oh, well, you know, if you change this, then people won't be able to find you as easily. And I'm like, oh, all right, that's nice.
All right. Well, let's see. People in the chat room are making me laugh, and I'm not going to talk about it. As I said earlier, feedback@macgeekgab.com is the address that you can use to email us whatever you like. Quick tips, please send them in. We would love to hear your quick tips, the things that you do And it's hard. I mean, we've been doing this show 10 years, and there's things that I've been doing for more than 10 years that we have yet to share in the show because they're just so automatic. So a little mindfulness helps the community in its entirety. So if you do come across something, and oftentimes these things come to me when somebody's looking over my shoulder and I do something, they're like, hey, what was that? I'm like, oh, yeah. Like the, you know, like last week, the iOS search thing. It was like, oh, dude, I've been doing this since iOS, you know, since I started using it. And I'm like, yep, had no idea. So anyway, that's the address.
You know what, Dave? John?
What's that?
I'm going to give you another address, Dave. And you know what it is? It's feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
Or premium at MacGeekGab.com. If you are a premium listener, we would we really appreciate your support, and we do answer your questions first. If you're interested in becoming a premium supporter here, MacGeekGab.com is the place to look. We would love iTunes comments from you. So just go to iTunes and leave us a comment. It can be good, it can be bad, it can be indifferent. We'd love to have your comments. We love to get them from all over the world. And the good news is we actually can see your comments from all over the world. We use a service called My Podcast Reviews that makes it really easy for us to see things in iTunes stores that are not our own. So please do, if you, no matter where you are, we would love to have a review from you on iTunes. So thank you for
Dave, you know what I saw the other day?
What'd you say?
And thank you to all our listeners. But yeah, I was looking through iTunes the other day. I think, well, one of our colleagues, I think Ken, our friend Ken, Ken Ray, had said, hey, look, I appeared on this iTunes list. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Let me see where MacGeekGab is. And we actually, briefly, I don't think we're there anymore, but we were in the What's Hot section of Software How To. We were number one. It was like,
that's
wow.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I love it.
And I think I saw Mac Power Users, you know, our friends,
David and Katie.
Yeah, they were up there too. Yeah, awesome. All the cool kids were there. But it was. I'm not sure what caused this to appear there. But part of it is,
it's you
listening and you telling it, and it's you, not you, and not that guy.
No, and definitely not him. Awesome. 206-666-GEEK. If you want to leave us a voicemail, it would be the number. And John, Geek is
4-3-3.
I want to thank the folks at Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. And of course, our wonderful sponsors who make all this possible. As we mentioned earlier, Harry's with coupon code SHAVE5OFF, Otherworld Computing at MaxSales.com, Linda at LYNDA.com/MGG, Barebones Software at Barebones.com, the folks at Gazelle are fantastic. Check them out, gazelle.com. Of course, we mentioned a blog post from iMazing. They're the makers, or DigiDNA, they're the makers of iMazing. Coupon code MGG saves you 20% there. SmileSoftware.com, Squarespace.com/MGG. Folks, if you celebrate Christmas, please do have a Merry Christmas. If you don't, have a fantastic week regardless, and have a wonderful it's been great. We'll talk to you again before the new year, so we won't wish anything about that yet, but thank you for everything. It really is a wonderful thing. John, any advice? Actually, I have one piece of advice to share, and then I'm looking to you for a piece of advice. We're recording this on Saturday. Tomorrow, Sunday, there's a big feature on 60 Minutes about Apple that should be interesting for those that are interested in that sort of thing. John, any advice from you?
The only advice I can give people, especially if you don't want to get any coal in your stocking, is don't get caught.